In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl, and I'm an experienced bartender.
And I'm Tommy Smurl. I'm an experienced drinker.
He's my dad, and together this is...
Neat! A weekly booze cast.
With history lessons, trivia, and a twist.
So pull up a stool to the bar and join us for the lowdown on your highball.
Hello again, Dad.
Well, hello again, Tater. How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. It's June 1st and we're recording this, so it's officially Pride Month. It's the 1 month out of the year that you're allowed to be gay, so, you know, I got to make the most of it.
Well, all right. We'll do that for a month.
There you go. We just had Memorial Day. I didn't do anything. I did work. Did you do anything nice for Memorial Day?
I just got older.
Oh, well, that's right. Dad also just had a birthday on Sunday, so on the 30th of May.
Yeah, that's right. So I just got older, but, you know, I woke up the next day, so that's good. That's winning.
It's dark. I mean, I'm glad. The alternative. Well, I'm of all the weekends to have a 3-day weekend, I was glad that this was one because I think we both had the same weather where it was just gross and dark and cold and rainy Saturday, Sunday. So I was glad Monday was a bit of a redo where you could just kind of have some time outside.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, we didn't go in the pool, but the granddaughters did.
Oh, nice.
They went in swimming, so it was warm enough for them, but kids, they don't care. They'll go outside in the snow. They'll jump in. They don't care.
They think it's fun to be cold, to get wet, to get dirty. Everything you try to avoid as an adult, you just love as a kid. I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't either. Go jump in the mud puddles.
Say, no. It's like, oh, an extreme temperature. I'm so excited. Why?
Yeah. Not me. I try to stay warm and dry.
Yep, just temperate. Comfortable at all times.
That's the secret to longevity. Staying warm and dry.
I believe that. You know, we did just celebrate, we just had Memorial Day. And it got me thinking about a certain topic, something we've kind of touched on in the past that I find uniquely fascinating. And that is the history of... rations in armed forces, really worldwide. I mean, we've had them here in America, but there's a long history back into antiquity of armed forces providing booze to their soldiers.
You know, and until I joined you on this podcast, I was not aware of that. I did not know that that was a regular thing, that the forces were given rations of alcohol. That just totally blew my mind that that was a thing.
It did mine when I first learned it, just because you don't think that, you think that would be like rule number one in like, here, we're going to give you a deadly weapon and, you know, you're going to go fight in a dangerous war.
Yeah.
Be sober, right?
Right. You would think your sobriety is pretty important to your survival, but apparently it's, you know, liquid courage, I think was the point to a lot of it, or keep you from complaining so much, maybe. I don't know.
Well, I mean, yeah, like drinking and warfare have really gone hand in hand since the earliest days of war. I mean, going all the way back to like the ancient Greeks and Romans, you would be enticed into joining the war effort by the promise of basically like all you could drink if you were victorious. And drinking, you know, while and before and after battle was a pretty normal practice. Now, that being said, both the Greeks and Romans probably had a decent amount of sobriety on the battlefield, because in both their cases, they were given some form of watered-down wine, which we talked about in our Rosé episode, how they had this mm-hmm. notion that, like, full-bodied, specifically red wine, was, like, would, like, incite madness, so you would water down your stronger right. wines. Mm-hmm. So the Greek forces were given watered-down wine, and the Romans were served pulska, which was similar to that. It was actually old, slightly turned wine that would be watered down, and they would give that to the Roman soldiers. So nothing too super strong. You know, you get something to get through the battle, but then the there, you know, dangling on the other side of your victory would be some massive party, drunken orgy that you would have access to.
Well, I also noticed in that Pasca that it was kind of like you say, it was wine that was starting to turn, so it was kind of vinegary. So it was probably giving them some electrolytes they weren't aware of, which was probably good for them going into battle. But they weren't doing it for that purpose.
Yeah. It's a good, there you go. You got ancient Roman Gatorade.
Yeah.
The Vikings, well, they were kind of known as being like this terrifying, like, drunken force. They really weren't all that, kind of similarly, they weren't super wasted going into battle, but they did have, like, and a lot of Germanic tribes at that time, they had a lot of customs involving alcohol. They had a very specific perception of alcohol as sort of a revealer of truths. So, like, if they were deciding whether or not they were going to go into battle, one of their traditions was like all parties involved would just get super smashed and then, you know, talk out the pros and cons of going into battle until they reached a decision, and they would decide this would be a sound one because, you know, this is their true selves that they have access to when they're intoxicated.
I think they knew they were going to go into battle. They just wanted an excuse to get drunk.
I mean, maybe, you know, but you find this idea in a lot of cultures, this notion of using alcohol as sort of a way of accessing inner truths. So it's not unfounded, but they were, you know, also definitely drinking in the act of battle, but had more of a reverent tradition built around it. In the Middle Ages, to say that any sort of army was drinking, everybody was drinking. I mean, water was dangerous, so everybody drank all the time. We've covered this. Beer or wine would not kill you, water would, so everybody was a little drunk. But we also have, like, the Crusades going on at this time period, like involving the Knights of Templar. And they were notorious drunks. They were just openly intoxicated as they went about their pillaging in the name of God. Drunk as a Templar was actually a term at the time to describe somebody who was just deeply intoxicated, because these crusades were so, like, well known to be just wasted.
Wow. Drunk as a Templar, huh? I haven't heard that. I've heard sober as a judge.
Well, there you go. Are you sober as a judge or drunk as a Templar?
Yeah.
Now, of course, as we get to the era of, like, British colonial expansionism and British rule, we really get the first codified, like, drinking ration in armed forces. But even before we get to the rations, this is also the introduction of alcohol as a powerful recruitment tool. Not just the promise of it, but many young men would be given copious free drinks at enlistment events, only to wake up with a hangover and a contract to serve the Royal Army. You see this recruitment tactic used in the British Army, in the American Army eventually. You know, you give a young dude some drinks, you say, hey, you got to sign up for the Army. He does it, and he's like, oops. I've done some stupid things when I've been wasted, but I've never committed my next decade or so to the armed forces, so, you know.
Well, that's how pirates did their recruiting as well, is they would get you drunk in the bar, and then they'd slip you out the back door, and you'd wake up on the ship already at sea, and you had no choice but to join those pirates.
Exactly.
That's how they got more crew.
Just the Army's way of doing the exact same thing.
Yeah, you remember that place that we went in Savannah when we were on the ghost tour? It was that bar that dated back to those days. Mm-hmm. And they had that, like, secret door back there that was in the corner that they would get them drunk. They open up the door, and it was like the laundry chute. And yep. they'd drop them down the laundry chute, and they'd be held in, like, a jail cell till they were ready to march them out onto the ship.
That's right. And then, and there's a lot of overlap, as we talked about on kind of the, like, that same British Navy strength episode, between, like, British Navy, but then you've got privateers, which were basically pirates, but pirates were still bad, except for when they did things that we liked, and then they were good. You know, you have a lot of overlap. There was a lot that the British military was sort of giving a wink and a nod to a lot of pirates at the time, giving them official contracts, but also they weren't held to, like, official constraints or any sense of morality. So you had a lot of these things going hand in hand.
Oh yeah, we did an episode about that on Court Appointed once.
Yeah,
and there was a lot of them that went back and forth. They operated as both privateers and pirates, and the only distinction is who they were working for and who paid the bill.
Exactly. And, you know, kind of, as long as they weren't doing anything that was counter to the British Empire, they were excused.
Yeah, like the English would pay them as long as they would go attack the French.
Right. But in the actual, like, Royal Army, the soldiers and sailors, their first codified rations, which is where we've talked about this before, the term tot, a tot of gin, or so. Of course, this term a tot, which is a ration, coming to us from the British Navy. Now, in the Napoleonic Wars, the British gained a reputation as being rather intoxicated. And they were, at the first, they were given a gallon of beer a day. So that was their tot. It was a gallon of beer. But as the British Empire expanded throughout the world, their rations kind of shifted to whatever was available. So it might be a pint of wine or arrack or gin or brandy. And of course, as the rum trade becomes immensely popular, it switches to rum. Now, along with this, you know, this colonialism, this commandeering land in other countries, they're also encountering a lot of new diseases, as we mentioned in our tonic episode. So the British troops involved in the colonizing efforts used alcohol to try to treat yellow fever, malaria, which might have had some help there with the gin and tonic, mm-hmm. infected wounds, dysentery, less good for, like, severe dehydration. Drink a gallon of wine. You'll be fine.
Well, you
very
know,
Winston, mixed results.
Winston Churchill was once quoted as saying that more Englishmen's lives and minds were saved by the gin and tonic than by all the doctors in the empire.
Well, he would say something like that. Famous, famous alcoholic Winston Churchill. but it was believed to be a curative at the time, and a stimulant also. You know, like if somebody is suffering from a bullet wound, just give them a whole bunch of rum and they'll feel better.
Yeah.
I guess, which would have been sort of true in the short term.
Well, that's true. That's like, they used whiskey during the Civil War for everything from a stimulant to rouse them up to pain for wounds to PTSD or stress. You know, they're like, okay, well, here, have a shot of whiskey then. That'll help calm your nerves.
Yeah. And it's not just like colloquial belief. This was something that was passed down from doctors. Doctors would prescribe for PTSD.
Absolutely.
Nowadays, I mean, you might self-medicate thusly, but we have a better understanding that that's not going to help.
Yeah, I don't think doctors prescribe drinking anymore.
No, I don't think so. Of course, on the high seas, where rum was the ration of choice, the British, they were starting to kind of have a realization, sort of a reckoning, that maybe this isn't actually as good for our forces as we think it is. There was a lot of concern. We're talking like the 1700s being voiced about, like, everybody's kind of drunk in our army and navy. So, like, they tried to take a couple steps to not anger the soldiers, but also reduce the drinking. They started diluting the rum. This was, of course, famously done by Admiral Edward Vernon. in the 1740s. We've talked about grog before, grog being like a Navy style punch. He was called Old Grog, and that was after his grog rim coat. So this was the fabric that the coat was made out of. He got the nickname Old Grog. This diluted rum which sometimes was then dressed up with lemon or lime, is sort of our rough grog punch that we have now, hence Old Grog being the reference to the diluted rum. Mm-hmm. All works. But you know, that didn't really work, because like the sailors would get pretty angry when they couldn't, when their rum wouldn't prove to be strong enough. They would like soak gunpowder in the rum and try to light it on fire, and if it didn't burst into flames, they're like, haha, it's been diluted, we're mad, we're gonna mutiny. So then they started trying to just give them the same amount but like twice a day instead of all at once. So they'd cut their ration in half. You get like half a pint of rum in the morning and half a pint in the evening. That's fine. Mm-hmm. that's not just gonna give you a nice slow steady drunk instead of a rise and a crash.
Well, you could always save your rations too, though.
Well, and a lot of them did. They wouldn't have their morning ration. They'd just take their morning ration with their night ration and just get wasted in the evening.
Right.
Now, one good thing, they in 1795, the British Navy added citrus to the ration, which was, they, you know, realized its connection to staving off scurvy. But then, like, you know, we get to the 1800s, like 1823 to 1850, they keep cutting the rations in half. And it also starts to fall out of favor with the sailors. Like, they're just not, like, it's not like you can't drink outside of this, you know. It becomes less of a thing that they're insisting upon. And at the same time, Parliament is discussing whether having this free alcohol be incentive for the military is a good idea. But it took all the way to 1970 to finally make an official decision to do away with it in the British Army. So that's
That hung in there a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was Admiral Peter Hill Norton abolished the rum rations on July 31st. And that day was known as Black Tot Day, the final day of the ration. And a lot of the sailors that were frustrated with it just threw their final ration into the sea in protest.
Well, that doesn't sound like a good plan. They won't let us drink. I'm going to throw mine away.
I guess it's just a symbolic gesture, you know.
I would have said, yeah, that was my rum, and it would have been water.
Well, now, you know, sort of concurrent to the stateside, a ration of booze was guaranteed to the American Army before America was even a country. All of those enlisted in the Revolutionary War were guaranteed. It was originally beer, as the Congress decided beer would be the alcohol of choice given to its newly minted army. But George Washington was really offended by this. He was like, yeah, they should get some beer, but they also need whiskey. We need to give them whiskey. He even fought for there to be distilleries solely in service to the troops. He didn't win that battle, but he did win the inclusion of what we called a gill, which was 4 ounces a day of whiskey. So under Washington's decision, the army was also given a gill of whiskey every day. He said the benefits arising from the moderate use of strong liquor have been experienced in all armies and are not to be disputed.
Well, I think that's kind of ironic when he was president then and had the whiskey rebellion he had to put down. And maybe that's why he was so lenient, because he had encouraged people to make the whiskey to supply the troops.
Well, and, you know, I think that the idea that, I mean, he was never anti-drinking. Washington was very pro-drinking.
Oh, he just wanted the money.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He wanted it taxed. He wanted money from it. But
right.
he was all about people getting wasted. Washington's kind of like the very focused colonial era Hemingway character in the history of drinking. Because all through this time period, like, you find a recipe for, like, milk punch, Washington had one. You find a recipe for, like, Applejack, Washington had one. Washington had a distillery. He had a preferred whiskey. Washington was a big drinker. Now, incidentally, the Revolutionary War also helped shift the American palate away from old world spirits, such as gin or brandy or rum. These things, I mean, just practically, they became increasingly harder to import during wartime. It was hard to get a hold of of molasses, and also the association to the old world, to the British crown, made them sort of lose favor with the colonists. You know, drinking whiskey was an act of patriotism, so
right.
You should support your local whiskey distillery.
Yeah, because somewhere the British government was getting a cut of taxes or something if you bought their stuff.
Exactly. So drink whiskey and be a good American.
That's right.
We still got to follow that. For 50 years, that daily gill was guaranteed to the American soldier. It equaled about a bottle a week per soldier, which meant tens of thousands of cases of whiskey flowing to the army from mainly primary distilling states of like Kentucky, Pennsylvania, and Virginia. And there was even like kind of a side business that popped up because you had drinking was okay, obviously, for the troops, but then they'd go through their 4 ounces a day, you know, their beer, and they'd need more. And so you'd have what were called sutlers. And they were basically these shops that would set up around like where army installations were. And they would have people that would go to the lines selling their wares, and they'd sell tobacco, they'd sell candy, they'd sell magazines, and they'd sell booze. And they were allowed to just, like, it reminds me like at a ball game where you have somebody walking around with like the box, you know, like popcorn, like Raisinets, but it's like, oh, cigarettes, whiskey, just on the front lines of like the Revolutionary War.
Cold beer here, cold beer here.
Basically, yeah. So, you know, obviously the army okayed this. It wasn't about this is how much we think you should drink a day. It was like, this is how much we'll give you. We don't care how much more you're drinking. You just have to buy it after that.
That's right. It's on your nickel after that.
Yeah. Now, of course, the free alcohol in the army dried up in 1832. That's when the ration was done away with. But there was still drinking going on in the armed forces. And in fact, the attitudes towards drinking might have had a hand in the outcome of the Civil War. So the South closed down pretty much all of its distilleries in order to focus on food production. And also they tore down their stills quite literally to make cannons. So they just, you know, distilling whiskey can wait. We've got to win this battle. However, in the North, the distilleries were allowed to keep cooking, and the alcohol taxes, which were now, you know, were allowed to be collected, went to fund the war effort. So this actually gave the North an upper hand because they had all this extra money, all this extra cash flow from allowing distilleries to continue on. And they also had a more relaxed view to drinking in the field. There's a famous exchange after notorious drinker General Ulysses S. Grant won a decisive victory in Vicksburg. Lincoln offered to send a case of his preferred spirit to every general in the army if it made them win victories like that.
Yeah, that's it. So support America, drink heavily.
I mean, yeah, you know, squash the Confederacy, drink some whiskey. Sounds good.
Yeah.
Now, on upwards into like World War One, the view on drinking in this particularly brutal, harsh, just plodding war for all forces involved is maybe best said by a German anti-fascist and World War One volunteer, Arnold Zweig, who said, it was possible for a man to fight a war without women, without ammunition, even without strong points, but not without tobacco and not at all without alcohol. World War One necessitated a lot of drinking.
Well, that was one. There wasn't a lot of technology. There was a lot of hand-to-hand combat and being in trenches and stuff like that. So that was a tough one.
And there were rules in place. Like, you were not allowed to be drunk in a trench. The punishment was death. But these were largely ignored because of how severe the conditions were. They just decided you needed to be a little drunk for it. The French army originally was only issued water rations, but very quickly they began being offered wine. It was what was dubbed Father Pignard. Pignard was basically just a low-quality red wine that started to be given out to the French army in World War One. They started off at a half liter a day. It increased from there, but it was very much beloved by the troops and sort of viewed as like their their force to get through the war. And of course, the German forces, they looted wineries and distilleries as they advanced into France. But they also brought with them German wine, beer, and of course, schnapps. They were given 125 milliliter ration of schnapps a day.
Hmm.
Now, famously, the Russian army was subjected to temperance under the rulership of Nicholas II. He prohibited the production of vodka entirely, and a mistake that, like, decreased morale and also just funds available to the Russians, led to like a pretty harsh downturn in the capabilities of the Russian army, and this was one that was a mistake that was purposely rectified in World War II by then Soviet leader Stalin. He kept his forces well lubricated. He like had an escalating ration of vodka. Like, there are reports of entirely smashed Russian units attacking Germans. They were rewarded for, they could, if you shot down a German plane, you got an extra deciliter of vodka. So, like, a lot of Russian valor in World War II was heavily vodka fuel. Russian writer Victor Erfeyer perhaps said it best. He said the daily ration of vodka given to Russian soldiers in World War II was as important as the Katyusha rocket launchers in the victory over Nazism.
Yeah, they said that that as they started winning the war, they kept upping the ration amount of vodka that they would get. And they said, while there's no doubt that the vodka helped the Russian army win the war, it said that if the men did not drink as much as they did, they would have been in Berlin 2 years earlier.
Well, that's valid.
Yeah, that was from the Russian hires up. That was what they decided. Yeah, we did win, but we could have been there 2 years earlier if we hadn't been drinking so much.
Oh. Well, it is interesting, this notion of drinking on the battlefield, that you have this benefit of I guess valor and courage, but then it's offset by perhaps a loss of reasoning skills.
Well, they were talking about one guy. This was during World War One. We were saying how bad it was, that he had saved up his ration for a week because he decided that the stress fighting in those trenches was too much for him. So he tried to drink himself to death. He tried to commit suicide by drinking himself to death. So he drank his, like, 2 weeks ration or something like that and passed out. And he woke up laying between trenches. He didn't know how he got there, but he was still alive. And at that point, he decided he wanted to live. So he climbed back in the trench and went back to fighting.
Well, that's dark, but that actually was a not uncommon tactic during World War One, where people would just try to save up their rations and check out via them.
Yeah. It was just a frightening place to be.
Yeah. Now, obviously, around the world, no standing army now has a recognized ration. I believe you had them hanging on in, like, Canada for a while, and then, New Zealand. But at this point, nobody has a standard ration. But that doesn't mean that serving in any military in any part of the world is a dry occasion. So, of course, back in the day, you know, on the front lines of, like, the Revolutionary War, we had the sutlers who would provide troops with what they needed. Now we just have stores on army bases providing plenty of liquor and beer to people that live on these bases.
The army canteen.
Yeah, you know, it's you have to buy it, but it's fine if you're drinking it. I mean, obviously, there are rules about sobriety in service, just like any other job, but there's not a prohibition of alcohol on army bases. In fact, the U.S. military is a pretty big purchaser of booze. They do a program with Jack Daniels. It's the Buy the Barrel program. They're the largest purchaser of this, where a service member can purchase an entire barrel of some of Jack Daniels' best whiskey. Now, obviously, they can't take the 560-pound barrel back to their house, but they can have that for them in the base store and be drained off, like, a bottle at a time into, like, 250 bottles. Huh. And just buy all at once.
So wow.
There's plenty of whiskey still being consumed by American forces.
I always remembered hearing on different movies and TV shows about the Officers Club, where they had higher class liquor available and it flowed more freely than in the regular soldiers canteen or whatever where they went. They didn't have the variety to choose from.
Mm-hmm. And that's true too in the British military. There was always better, higher grade spirits available to those in charge, and you know they didn't necessarily have to abide by the ration rule.
Yeah.
But yeah, so you know, a lot of drinking on the battlefield historically kind of hard to judge one way or the other, because you know what, I don't know how you get through those sort of situations sober, but I guess that's probably the safer way too. I don't know.
Well, I read a couple of other interesting stories associated with the military and drinking. One came from Nazi Germany. And that's Jägermeister. Jägermeister translates to roughly master of the hunt. So this was a drink that they would drink before they would go out like hunting in the woods, and then later as they were performing military duties in the woods and stuff. And they would drink this drink that later became Jägermeister, but at the time they called it Göring Schnaps, named after the number two man for Hitler, Hermann Göring. It's an
unfortunate legacy for Jägermeister.
Yeah, I know. I didn't know it had that kind of connections.
Yikes.
And then they talk about the Battle of El Alamein, where the British fought to keep the Germans out of Cairo. And although historians will say as much, a drink helped win this battle. They said Germans famed General Erwin Rommel was closing in on Cairo looking to cut off the British supply chain. And as resources in the city were getting scarce, bad liquor began flowing. UK troops complained about worsening hangovers, which was not an ideal scenario while they were just barely clinging on to defend the city from falling. So in the face of these high-pressure stakes, the hotel shepherd bartender Joe Scallion came up with a solution. He dubbed it the Suffering Bastard. The drink, which has been recreated by Angel's Envy, combined whatever gin Scallion could acquire, bitters made by a Greek man across the street, and stolen dark spirits and ginger beer. It quickly became known as a hangover cure among the British forces. So after Rommel and company finally confronted the British stand, Scallion fielded an odd request, and he asked that since the battle waged on over nights and days, that to take the stress off, they needed a drink. So the bartender received a telegram from the front lines. Can you please send 8 gallons of Suffering Bastard? Everyone is really hungover. Scallion filled every thermos he could find, coaxing any available taxis to bring the liquids to the needy UK front line. And according to Barry, the generals on the scene would later confirm the order was in fact placed. And history shows that the Battle of El Alamein was won by the British cavalry with an apparent taste for the Suffering Bastard.
Well, it's a good name.
Have you ever heard of that drink?
I've heard of that drink. I didn't know that that's where the history comes from.
Well, apparently it was. And then the other one that I found was that, the Navy had the U.S. Navy had they were dry. They would not allow you to drink at sea. But unfortunately, the people that were on the submarines figured out that torpedo fuel was basically grain alcohol.
Uh-oh.
So they would get in the habit of finding the torpedo fuel and draining it off, and they were all, our naval forces were drinking torpedo fuel.
Well, I guess if you dilute it enough, you're at vodka eventually.
They said that they would basically, it was like Everclear,
yeah,
and that they would add like a cheap grenadine or maraschino cherry juice to it and drink it like that. And they said it was very effective in achieving the desired result.
Believe that. Yikes.
It'll launch torpedoes, or you can have it as a beverage.
Whatever gets you there, man.
There's got to be some drinks named for that, you know? I mean, something with a torpedo?
Just Everclear maraschino cherries. Yep,
there you go. Yeah. Oof. Oh, man. and don't smoke while you're drinking it, because you might set yourself on fire.
Yikes. Well, you know, however you feel about drinking, however you feel about armed forces, that's up to you. But there is a deep and entangled history of the two of them together.
Well, you know what they say, war is hell. So that takes the edge off of hell a little bit.
I guess so. well, you know, two drinks, and this was definitely would have been something served in the officers' club and not on the front lines. Two drinks that come about from wartime and are named sort of in honor of various elements of wartime are the French 75, which we talked about. It's named after a piece of French artillery, and the sidecar, which is actually named after like the little sidecar on the motorcycle.
The motorcycle, yeah. The Germans used a lot of those. I think maybe the British Army used them too, but mostly in movies you see the Germans running around in those things.
Well, these both come to us from World War One. Mm-hmm. Both of these drinks were sort of minted, and I think it's a good sort of pair along with this episode, because I don't know if I want to try any of those frontline cocktails. We made a Navy grog back on our Navy Strength Gin episode, and that was pretty good. That was pretty good. You know, you get the basics of like a good punch build when you look at grog recipes, so you can't go wrong with that. But I thought we could be a little classy this week on the video and make some World War One inspired cocktails.
Well, that's better than going to the liquor store and asking for torpedo fuel.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely had some, what is it called? Rectified spirit is the translation, and it's slightly higher alcohol than Everclear, and my liquor store sells it. They started selling it during early quarantine days because all of the stores up here in New York were sold out of, like, hand sanitizer, anything. Yeah. Like that. Yeah. So they just started advertising having this, and it's like a Polish spirit, and it's incredibly high in alcohol. I've tried to drink it before just out of sheer morbid curiosity. It doesn't taste like anything because your tongue is instantly just like it's just dried out. It tastes like it hates you. I don't
like just like Malort.
No, Malort has a lot of flavor. This has no flavor, just like burn. It just like desiccates your mouth. It just like you, it's like I forget how the percentage. It's not. You shouldn't drink it. Don't drink it. But that's probably about as close as you could get to something. And I don't want to drink that again. I don't want to have that with maraschino cherries.
If your car runs out of gas, you can just pour a bottle of that in the tank.
I mean, probably. That's what I got, like two bottles of that, not to drink during quarantine. Although those early days of quarantine felt like that was the time to drink rectified spirit.
Sure.
But it was great for, like, I just put it in a spray bottle and would wipe my hands down with it, my shoes down with it, my takeout down with it, you know? I guess I could have probably powered a torpedo with it.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Well, all right. So, yes.
All right. We'll look forward to making those.
Yeah, check us out over on the video. We'll be making some World War One era cocktails and and there's your little rundown of the armed forces and their love of a drink.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. Well, thank you, Dad, for being here, as always.
Well, thank you, Tater, for having me. It's a pleasure. I always learn something every time.
Yeah. Me too. And thank you. Thank you, everybody, for listening in. If you would like to find us on social media, we are Neat Boozecast on Twitter and Instagram. We have a Patreon. If you want to give us some support, get some stickers, get some coasters, you can check that out. If you want to email us, you can email us at neattheboozecast@gmail.com. And if you want to join our Facebook group, Dad's been heading that up.
Neat the Boozecast group. Page there. We're on there.
Group page there.
Just join. We'll be there. We'll let you in.
That'll be there. All right. Well, hey, I've been Taylor Smurl.
I've been Tommy Smurl.
And this has been
me.
Yeah, it's really interesting when you kind of lay the film of the presence of alcohol over really all history, because you see how there's a lot.
They said most of our fighter pilots, that these planes were not very well built. They were highly flammable and all this kind of stuff. And most people couldn't take the stress of going up there after a few times because they felt so lucky to get back. So they had to drink to go back up. And some of those famous fighter pilots were drunk the whole time they were fighting. That's a FUI or FWI, flying while intoxicated.
Oh, I don't. I think is that a charge?
Flying under the influence. In the future, it will be when we have flying cars.
You know, the government recently came forward about the fact that there are UFOs. So I don't know.
I know. Yeah, I've known it all along.
Have you? Wait, what?
Yeah, I always knew there was. I knew those things had to be. There's too many of them for them all to be fake. There had to be something. Where there's smoke, there's fire.
I like this casual admittance of believing in aliens that you just gave forth. Oh, yeah.
They're there. They're there. They just don't trust us to behave properly yet. We haven't evolved enough. They're way smarter than us. That doesn't take much. The bar is not very high.
Yeah, that's what I just, I feel like whatever, anything that they want to know about us, they've probably already figured out. Like, and maybe the ones that still show up here, maybe they're on a little drunken joyride, you know?
I mean, we're not even all smart enough to go get a vaccination because we don't believe it's real to save us from a deadly disease. So they don't have to be that smart to be smarter than us.
No.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.